What a time of hope and pride for our congregation and our city. Today, we celebrate the life and the ministry of one of the greatest spiritual leaders of our nation and the world, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And tomorrow, we engage in acts of education and service and advocacy with approximately 70,000 people from around the region. Philadelphia is the biggest Dr. King Day of Service location in the country. And on this sacred weekend, let us also remember Trayvon Martin. It was only 11 months ago when 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was wearing a hoodie sweatshirt walking through a gated community where he was staying with his father and his father's fiancée. He was staying with them for the last week because he had been suspended from school where he lived with his mother because he had residue of drugs in his backpack. George Zimmerman was an off-duty town watch volunteer who called 911 saying he had spotted a suspicious young man walking in the neighborhood. As he was still on the call with the operator, Mr. Zimmerman told them he was following the young man while he was driving his car, and the operator told him to stop doing that, but he continued. Commotion between Zimmerman and Martin ensued. To date, nobody can say for sure what exactly happened next, except that Mr. Zimmerman shot Mr. Martin dead, and Mr. Martin had no weapons on his body. The trial is still going to court in process, and Mr. Zimmerman claims that he shot Trayvon in self-defense. His lawyer claims that shooting was protected by stand your ground law in Florida, which allows a person to shoot somebody else in self-defense. Trayvon Martin was a young African-American male, meaning he is in a demographic which too often has been systematically put down and shut out by our society. Living out the Dr. King tradition, we are called to bring more justice to the prison system, and in doing so, to fight racism and increase fairness and compassion. Now, Trayvon Martin was not in the prison system, but as a young African-American male, he suffered the fate of millions of others in what Michelle Alexander calls the modern-day racial caste system, or the new Jim Crow. Jim Crow was a set of laws put into place after slavery to keep African-Americans in check. So much of what I'm going to say is based on this book. The scope of the problem is massive. Here are some critical points. The number of prisoners in the United States has grown exponentially over the last decades. After barely budging for 50 years, our incarceration rate increased sevenfold between 1978 and 2008. Currently, the United States has the highest rate of incarceration per person in the world. Our inmates, 1.5 million in prison, with another 800,000 in jail, comprise 22% of the world's prisoners. 22% of the world's prisoners, we are 4.5% of the world's population and the richest country in the world. Shocking to many is the fact that crime rates have not grown in that time. It is the change of policies that have filled the prisons and the jails. Michelle Alexander argues that the war on drugs is at the heart of these misguided changes. Disproportionately high numbers of blacks and Latinos are targets. Even though white people commit a majority of the drug crimes, using and selling, 75% of those in jail are black and Latino. The federal government has poured massive resources into militarizing the effort. They have attempted, and in many cases succeeded, in supplying heavy weaponry to cities everywhere. As an example, the mayor of New Haven, Connecticut, told the New York Times he was offered bazookas, tanks, and anything he wanted. Another example of the intense violence put into these efforts involves SWAT teams, special weapons and tactics teams, the black clothes and helmet guys who come in real quiet and then bang in. In the United States in 1972, there were a couple hundred SWAT operations throughout the country. By 2001, there were 40,000 SWAT operations, the large majority related to drugs. Most often, the war on drugs is directed at neighborhoods with high concentrations of poor folks and folks of color, instead of white, affluent neighborhoods where folks are also using and selling lots of drugs. Most studies show that people buy drugs from people who look and have similar life situations to them. There is too much discretion in the system, which allows police latitude in deciding who to target for stop and search, investigations, and seizures. The majority of cases do not get settled in court, but in mediation and bargaining, and prosecutors have too much discretion for strategy and decisions about plea bargains. The large latitude given to police and prosecutors creates bias in the practice. Decades of cognitive bias research demonstrates, almost without question, that both unconscious and conscious bias leads to discriminatory actions even when the individual does not want to discriminate. Even when somebody says in their heart, I don't want to treat a black person and a white person differently, study after study shows that we do. Next, there's too much harsh punishment. And insufficient supports for rehabilitation and creating pathways for people to return to good status. I worked jail chaplaincy, maximum security in Chicago. There was no AA, there was no Narcotics Anonymous, there was no counselors for drug or alcohol abuse or emotional problems. There's no ways to help people get back to track so they'd be ready to go back into their neighborhood. That's very common. The famous policy of three strikes, you're out, has unreasonably devastated people's lives. With prison, parole, probation, out of work, out of luck, you're stuck. This is because the three strikes, you're out, which sounds so harsh, is tied to other policies like one strike, you're out, for public housing and many assistance programs like food stamps. One felony, a bag of marijuana that's too big, and you might never be able to live in a place or have enough food for your family again in the United States of America. In alignment with that, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, known as the moderate swing voter on the conservative court, Justice Kennedy said, I can accept neither the necessity nor the wisdom of federal mandatory minimum sentences. He said, many of our punishments and sentences are too severe. I cannot accept them. In one more area of punishment, the United States stands alone in the methods of disenfranchising folks who have done time in prison. The United Nations Human Rights Commission has charged the United States with violation of international law and how we take away the right to vote with folks who have been behind bars. The last major piece of the caste system involves the ways in which the courts have been closed off for civil rights challenges. Alexander says, in the 90s, we heard a lot about abuse of folks of color driving while black and all the different harassment and problems. She says that problem has not been really reduced. It's just the remedies in the courts have been so shut off, it gets much less media. A great example involves Adolph Lyon's attempt to ban the use of lethal chokeholds by the Los Angeles Police Department. Mr. Lyons was a 24-year-old black man driving his car in LA when the police pulled him out for a burned-out taillight. With guns drawn, the police ordered Lyons out of his car. He obeyed. They ordered him to face the car, spread his legs, put his hands on his head. He did it. At one point, Mr. Lyons moved his hands down. They smacked him back up on his head. And then he said his hand was cramping by holding his car keys. At that point, the police officer put him in a chokehold where he lost consciousness and collapsed. He lost control of his bodily functions, dirtied himself. There was blood all over the place. It was a very ugly, dangerous situation. Lyons sued the city of Los Angeles to get them to stop chokeholds. By the time the case got to the Supreme Court, 16 people had been killed by chokeholds. 12 of them were black folks, black men. The court ruled against the ban on chokeholds, saying they would only grant standing in the case if Mr. Lyons proved first, this is the United States Supreme Court saying this would only be a valid case if, one, he proved that all police officers in LA always choke any citizen with whom they have any encounter for an arrest, or two, proved that the city orders the police to do this. If he couldn't prove either of those, he had no case. So the bar is so ridiculously high, the courts, the civil rights movement is just totally changed of how the courts are being used. It's unacceptable. Living out the Dr. King tradition, we are called to bring more justice to the prison system, and in doing so, fight racism and increase fairness and compassion. Now, friends, I've been reading this book for a month. It's daunting. This is overwhelming. It's a big order. The question is, what can we do? What can we do? Well, let's start with this. On this weekend, we must remember that with his entire being, Dr. King was dedicated to taking major issues head on. He said the church must be the guide and the critic of the state, never its tool. If the church does not recapture its prophetic zeal, it will become an irrelevant social club without moral or spiritual authority. The church must be the guide and the critic of the state. If the church does not recapture its prophetic zeal, it will become an irrelevant social club without moral or spiritual authority. We are thrilled to be a headquarters for Dr. King Day of Service. It is a great thing for our spiritual lives and I think for our neighborhoods. But we can't say that we're just going to paint homeless shelters and clean the streets and feed the hungry. That's not the full King vision and mission. And I believe very strongly that in our current context, we are called upon to shake the foundations. This year, the Pennsylvania legislature and the governor passed and signed a bill, 1485, which set aside $685 million to build new prisons and removed funding from education. Thankfully, some wonderful advocacy groups have organized protests and obstacles for implementation. Our education justice team is getting involved in moving the effort forward to bring back some dollars with common sense to our education system in Philly and Pennsylvania. And recently, Governor Corbett, under the pressure of other advocacy groups like Decarcerate PA, which our Ending Racism team is working for, the governor said he's going to stop the building of two of the prisons that $685 million was going to. This is good, in my opinion. I encourage us to thank him, encourage him to do more. Tomorrow, one of our advocacy programs is to stop building more prisons in PA. I am 110% for that. If you can get involved today, tomorrow, and the next day in that advocacy effort. And I think the governor is paying attention. He doesn't have a lot of options in his budget as well. We need to advocate for rehabilitation, job training, health care, housing opportunities. Our economic justice team is working with UU Plan, our state advocacy group, for restaurant worker fair pay and sick leave. Restaurant workers have very bad laws supporting them and many of them are abused by the owners of restaurants because they can get away with it. So these kind of changes create good pathways back for folks out of the mass incarceration. A year ago, I think a very good law was enacted in Philadelphia, ban the box. This is a law that's found in a few states and cities around the country that prohibits employers from putting a checkbox on a job application asking an ex-offender, if you've been an ex-offender, and you can't ask it in a first interview. The rationale for the law is too many folks are put in a box and then the key is thrown away. And they never have a chance to even get their foot in the door to show their skills or their energy to help somewhere as an employee. Living out the Dr. King tradition, we are called to bring more justice to the prison system, and in doing so, fight racism and increase fairness and compassion. So I think, as we know, most spiritual practices are important to live out at the corporate level. If we're trying to say, let's not put people in a box and throw away the key forever, we should ask, how do we do that sometimes in our personal lives? How do we put people in boxes that denigrate them or unfairly close out opportunities for grace? Frederick Douglass said, "Men are so constituted that they derive their conviction of their own possibilities largely from the estimates formed of them by others. If nothing is expected of a people, that people will find it difficult to contradict that expectation." Many who study and worry about the prison industrial complex feel that the words criminal and felon are the new methods of branding. One compelling minister I heard preach said that now that the huge majority of folks accept that one cannot say the N-word when referring to African Americans, folks are defaulting to felon and criminal. We know that in spirituality, if we're going to care about applying principles to the national level, we have to apply them to the personal level. So here at USG, we can work to not put each other in boxes, not lock away the key. In the living of our lives, we have all been wronged, and we have all done wrong to others. I myself have broken many drug laws. It's been a long time for me, but I have, and the President of the United States has broken many drug laws. He's told the story. And the statistics show that the majority of Americans have broken drug laws. I'm pretty sure if we did a survey of everybody sitting in the pews today, we would have over 50%. A lot of smiles. But the thing is, we can't put the capital S sinner on certain people and the capital V victim on others and say, okay, we'll divide everybody up now and that's the way we'll live. We know that's ridiculous. So let's not entertain the absurd charade that only folks involved in the drug industry and the lower racial caste of America should have their lives ruined forever. Perhaps we can improve as a nation if, as individuals, we more rigorously apply forgiveness and atonement. The mission of our congregation is building beloved community with compassion, service, and empowerment. Thus, I believe we should throw our lot in with the movement to truly challenge mass incarceration, and in doing so, we must clearly confront the role of race. We must also cultivate an ethic of genuine care, compassion, and concern for every human being. This is the work of our congregation. If you're checking us out, this is what we're about. This is who you're visiting today. In all these efforts, we can make King's dream and our dreams a reality. All of this helps us to rise up as a nation and live out our true meaning of the creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal. All this helps us to rise up as a nation so that families of former slaves and family of former slave owners can sit down at the table of brother and sisterhood. All of this helps us to realize that, like Dr. King said, everybody can be great because everybody can serve. Everybody can be great because everybody can try to love somebody. Everybody can be great because everybody can try to reduce their carbon footprint. Everybody can be great because everybody can bring an open mind and a compassionate heart to the system of mass incarceration in the United States of America. Everybody can be great because everybody can try to feed the hungry. Everybody can be great because everybody can clothe those who are naked. Everybody can be great because everybody can visit those in prison. Everybody can be great because everybody can serve humanity. Blessings be. Amen.